to Vera. Foreword. The greater part of the gift, in Russian dar, was written in 1935 to 1937 in Berlin. Its last chapter was completed in 1937 on the French Riviera. The leading émigré magazine, Современные записки, conducted in Paris by a group of former members of the Social Revolutionary Party, published the novel serially, 63-67, 1937-38, omitting, however, Chapter 4, which was rejected for the same reasons that the biography it contains was rejected by Vasiliev in Chapter 3. A pretty example of life finding itself obliged to imitate the very art it condemns. Only in 1952, almost 20 years after it was begun, did there appear an entire edition of the novel, brought out by that Samaritan organization, the Chekhov Publishing House, New York. It is fascinating to imagine the regime under which Dar may be read in Russia. I had been living in Berlin since 1922, thus synchronously with the young man of the book. But neither this fact, nor my sharing some of his interests, such as literature and Lepidoptera, should make one say, aha, and identify the designer with the design. I am not, and never was, Fyodor Godunov Cherdintsev. My father is not the explorer of Central Asia that I still may become some day. I never wooed Zina Mertz, and never worried about the poet Koncheyev or any other writer. In fact, it is rather in Koncheyev, as well as in another incidental character, the novelist Vladimirov, that I distinguish odds and ends of myself as I was circa 1925. In the days I worked on this book, I did not have the knack of recreating Berlin and its colony of expatriates as radically and ruthlessly as I have done in regard to certain environments in my later English fiction. History shows through artistry. Fyodor's attitude toward Germany reflects too typically, perhaps, the crude and irrational contempt that Russian émigrés had for the natives in Berlin, Paris, or Prague. My young man is moreover influenced by the rise of a nauseous dictatorship belonging to the period when the novel was written and not to the one it patchily reflects. The tremendous outflow of intellectuals that formed such a prominent part of the general exodus from Soviet Russia in the first years of the Bolshevist Revolution seems today like the wanderings of some mythical tribe whose bird signs and moon signs I now retrieve from the desert dust. We remained unknown to American intellectuals who, bewitched by communist propaganda, saw us merely as villainous generals, oil magnates, and gaunt ladies with lorgnettes. That world is now gone. Gone are Bunin, Aldanov, Remizov. Gone is Vladislav Khodasyevich, the greatest Russian poet that the 20th century has yet produced. The old intellectuals are now dying out and have not found successors in the so-called displaced persons of the last two decades who have carried abroad the provincialism and philistinism of their Soviet homeland. The world of the gift, being at present as much of a phantasm as most of my other worlds, I can speak of this book with a certain degree of detachment. It is the last novel I wrote, or ever shall write, in Russian. Its heroine is not Zina, but Russian literature. The plot of Chapter 1 centers in Fyodor's poems. Chapter 2 is a surge toward Pushkin in Fyodor's literary progress and contains his attempt to describe his father's zoological explorations. Chapter 3 shifts to Gogol, but its real hub is the love poem dedicated to Zina. Fyodor's book on Chernyshevsky, A Spiral Within a Sonnet, takes care of Chapter 4. The last chapter combines all the preceding themes and adumbrates the book Fyodor dreams of writing someday, The Gift. I wonder how far the imagination of the reader will follow the young lovers after they have been dismissed. The participation of so many Russian muses within the orchestration of the novel makes its translation especially hard. My son Dmitri Nabokov completed the first chapter in English, but was prevented from continuing by the exigencies of his career. The four other chapters were translated by Michael Scammell. In the winter of 1961 at Montreux, I carefully revised the translation of all five chapters. I am responsible for the versions of the various poems and bits of poems scattered throughout the book. The epigraph is not a fabrication. The epilogic poem mimics an Onegin stanza. Vladimir Nabokov, Montreux, March 28, 1962. The Gift. An oak is a tree, a rose is a flower, a deer is an animal, a sparrow is a bird, Russia is our fatherland, death is inevitable. P. Smirnovsky, A Textbook of Russian Grammar. Chapter 1. One cloudy but luminous day, towards 4 in the afternoon, on April the 1st, 1920 blank, a foreign critic once remarked that while many novels, most German ones for example, begin with a date, it is only Russian authors who, in keeping with the honesty peculiar to our literature, omit the final digit. A moving van, very long and very yellow, hitched to a tractor that was also yellow, with hypertrophied rear wheels and a shamelessly exposed anatomy, pulled up in front of number 7 Tannenberg Street in the west part of Berlin. The van's forehead bore a star-shaped ventilator. Running along its entire side was the name of the moving company in yard-high blue letters, each of which, including a square dot, was shaded laterally with black paint, a dishonest attempt to climb into the next dimension. On the sidewalk before the house, in which I too shall dwell, stood two people who had obviously come out to meet their furniture. In my suitcase there are more manuscripts than shirts. The man, arrayed in a rough greenish-brown overcoat to which the wind imparted a ripple of life, was tall, beetle-browed, and old, with the grey of his whiskers turning to russet in the area of the mouth, in which he insensitively held a cold, half-defoliated cigar butt. The woman, thick-set and no longer young, with bow legs and a rather attractive pseudo-Chinese face, wore an astrakhan jacket. The wind, having rounded her, brought a whiff of rather good but slightly stale perfume. They both stood motionless and watched fixedly with such attentiveness that one might think they were about to be short-changed as three red-necked husky fellows in blue aprons wrestled with their furniture. Some day, he thought, I must use such a scene to start a good, thick, old-fashioned novel. The fleeting thought was touched with a careless irony. An irony, however, that was quite unnecessary, because somebody within him, on his behalf, independently from him, had absorbed all this, recorded it, and filed it away. He himself had only moved in today, and now, for the first time, in the still unaccustomed state of local resident, he had run out to buy a few things. He knew the street, and indeed the whole neighborhood. The boarding-house from which he had moved was not far. Until now, however, the street had revolved and glided this way and that without any connection with him. Today it had suddenly stopped. Henceforth it would settle down as an extension of his new domicile. Lined with lindens of medium size, with hanging droplets of rain distributed among their intricate black twigs according to the future arrangement of leaves, tomorrow each drop would contain a green pupil, complete with a smooth tarred surface some 30 feet across, and variegated sidewalks, hand-built and flattering to the feet, it rose at a barely perceptible angle, beginning with a post office and ending with a church, like an epistolary novel. With a practiced eye, he searched it for something that would become a daily sore spot, a daily torture for his senses. But there seemed to be nothing of that sort in the offing, and the diffuse light of the gray spring day was not only above suspicion, but even promised to mollify any trifle that in more brilliant weather would not fail to crop up. This could be anything, the color of a building, for instance, that immediately provoked an unpleasant taste in the mouth, a smack of oatmeal, or even halva. An architectural detail that effusively caught one's attention every time one passed by. The irritating sham of a caryatid, a hanger-on and not a support, which even under a lighter burden would crumble into plaster dust. Or on a tree trunk, fastened to it by a rusty thumbtack, a pointless but perpetually preserved corner of a notice in longhand, runny ink, blue runaway dog, that had outlived its usefulness but had not been fully torn off. Or else an object in a shop window, or a smell that refused at the last moment to yield a memory it had seemed ready to shout and remained instead on its street corner, a mystery withdrawn into itself. No, there was nothing like that. Not yet, in any case. It would be a good idea, he thought, sometime, at leisure, to study the sequence of three or four kinds of shops, and see if he were right in conjecturing that such a sequence followed its own law of composition, so that, having found the most frequent arrangement, one could deduce the average cycle for the streets of a given city. For example, tobacco shop, pharmacy, greengrocery. On Tannenberg Street, these three were dissociated, occurring on different corners. Perhaps, however, the rhythmic swarming had not yet established itself, and in the future, yielding to that counterpoint, as the proprietors either went broke or moved, they would gradually begin to gather according to the proper pattern. The green grocery, with a glance over its shoulder, would cross the street, so as to be at first seven, and then three doors away from the pharmacy, in somewhat the same way as the jumbled letters find their places in a film commercial, and at the end there is always one that does a kind of flip and then hastily assumes its position, a comic character, the inevitable Jack the Sack among the new recruits. And thus they will wait until an adjacent place becomes vacant, whereupon they will both wink across at the tobacco shop as if to say, "Quick, over here," and before you know it, they're all in a row forming a typical line. God, how I hate all this. The things in the shop windows, the obtuse face of merchandise, and above all, the ceremonial of transaction, the exchange of cloying compliments before and after. And those lowered lashes of modest price, the nobility of the discount, the altruism of advertisements, all of this nasty imitation of good, which has a strange way of drawing in good people. Alexandra Yakovlevna, for example, confessed to me that when she goes shopping in familiar stores, she is morally transplanted to a special world where she grows intoxicated from the wine of honesty, from the sweetness of mutual favors, and replies to the salesman's incarnadine smile with a smile of radiant rapture. The type of Berlin store that he entered can adequately be determined by the presence in a corner of a small table holding a telephone, a directory, narcissi in a vase, and a large ashtray. This shop did not carry the Russian-tipped cigarettes that he preferred, and he would have left empty-handed if it had not been for the tobacconist's speckled vest with mother-of-pearl buttons and his pumpkin-colored bald spot. Yes, all my life I shall be getting that extra little payment in kind to compensate my regular overpayment for merchandise foisted on me. As he crossed toward the pharmacy at the corner, he involuntarily turned his head because of a burst of light that had ricocheted from his temple, and saw, with that quick smile with which we greet a rainbow or a rose, a blindingly white parallelogram of sky being unloaded from the van. A dresser with mirror, across which, as across a cinema screen, passed a flawlessly clear reflection of boughs sliding and swaying, not arboreally, but with a human vacillation, produced by the nature of those who were carrying this sky, these boughs, this gliding facade. He walked on toward the shop, but what he had just seen, whether because it had given him a kindred pleasure, or because it had taken him unawares and jolted him, as children in the hayloft fall into the resilient darkness, released in him that pleasant something which for several days now had been at the murky bottom of his every thought, taking possession of him at the slightest provocation. My collection of poems has been published. And when, as now, his mind tumbled like this, that is, when he recalled the 50-odd poems that had just come out, he would skim in an instant the entire book, so that in the instantaneous mist of its madly accelerated music, one could not make any readable sense of the flicking lines. The familiar words would rush past, swirling amid violent foam, whose seething was transformed into a mighty flowing motion, if one fixed one's eyes on it, as we used to do long ago looking down at it from a vibrating mill bridge, until the bridge turned into a ship's stern. Farewell. And this foam, and this flickering, and a separate verse that rushed past all alone, shouting in wild ecstasy from afar, probably calling him home, all of this, together with the creamy white of the cover, was merged in a blissful feeling of exceptional purity. What am I doing? He thought, abruptly coming to his senses and realizing that the first thing he had done upon entering the next shop was to dump the change he had received at the tobacconist's onto the rubber eyelet in the middle of the glass counter, through which he glimpsed the submerged treasure of flasked perfumes, while the salesgirl's gaze, condescending toward his odd behavior, followed with curiosity this absent-minded hand paying for a purchase that had not yet been named. "A cake of almond soap, please," he said with dignity. Thereupon he returned with the same springy step to the house. The sidewalk before it was now empty save for three blue chairs that looked as if they had been placed together by children. Within the van, a small brown piano lay supine, tied up so that it could not rise, and with its two little metal soles up in the air. On the stairs he met the movers pounding down, knees turned out, and as he was ringing the doorbell of his new abode, he heard voices and hammering upstairs. His landlady let him in and said that she had left his keys in his room. This large, predatory German woman had a funny name, Clara Staboy, which to a Russian's ear sounded with a sentimental firmness as Clara is with thee, Staboy. And here is the oblong room and the patiently waiting suitcase. And at this point his carefree mood changed to revulsion. God forbid that anyone know the awful, degrading boredom, the recurrent refusal to accept the vile yoke of recurrent new quarters, the impossibility of living face to face with totally strange objects, the inevitability of insomnia on that daybed. For some time he stood by the window. In the curds and whey sky, opaline pits now and then formed where the blind sun circulated, and in response, on the grey convex roof of the van, the slender shadows of linden branches hastened headlong toward substantiation, but dissolved without having materialized. The house directly across the way was half enclosed in scaffolding, while the sound part of its brick facade was overgrown with window-invading ivy. At the far end of the path that cut through its front yard, he could make out the black sign of a coal cellar. Taken by itself, all this was a view, just as the room was itself a separate entity. But now a middleman had appeared, and now that view became the view from this room and no other. The gift of sight which it now had received did not improve it. It would be hard, he mused, to transform the wallpaper, pale yellow with bluish tulips, into a distant steppe. The desert of the desk would have to be tilled for a long time before it could sprout its first rhymes, and much cigarette ash would have to fall under the armchair and into its folds before it would become suitable for traveling. The landlady came to call him to the telephone, and he, politely stooping his shoulders, followed her into the dining room. "In the first place, my dear sir," said Alexander Yakovlevich Chernyshevsky, Why are they so reluctant at your old boarding house to divulge your new number? Left there with a bang, didn't you? In the second place, I want to congratulate you. What? You haven't heard yet? Honestly?
He hasn't heard anything about it yet, said Alexander Yakovlevich, turning the other side of his voice towards someone out of the range of the telephone.
Well, in that case, get a firm grip on yourself and listen to this. I'm going to read it to you. The newly published collection of poems by the hitherto unknown author Fyodor Godunov-Cherdintsev strikes one as such a brilliant phenomenon, and the poetic talent of the author is so indisputable. You know what? I shan't go on. But you come over to our place tonight. Then you'll get the whole article. No, Fyodor Konstantinovich, my good friend, I won't tell you anything now. Neither who wrote this review, nor in what emigre Russian language paper it appeared. But if you want my personal opinion, then don't be offended, but I think the fellow is treating you much too kindly. So you'll come? Excellent. We'll be expecting you.
As he hung up the receiver, Fyodor nearly knocked the stand with flexible steel rod and attached pencil off the table. He tried to catch it, and it was then that he did knock it off. Then he bumped his hip against the corner of the sideboard. Then he dropped a cigarette that he was pulling out of the pack as he walked. And finally he miscalculated the swing of the door, which flew open so resonantly that Frau Staboy, just then passing along the corridor with a saucer of milk in her hand, uttered an icy oops. He wanted to tell her that her pale yellow dress with bluish tulips was beautiful, that the parting in her frizzled hair and the quivering bags of her cheeks endowed her with a George Sandesque regality, that her dining room was the height of perfection. But he limited himself to a beaming smile, and nearly tripped over the tiger stripes which had not kept up with the cat as it jumped aside. After all, though, he had never doubted that it would be this way, that the world, in the person of a few hundred lovers of literature who had left St. Petersburg, Moscow, and Kiev, would immediately appreciate his gift. We have before us a thin volume entitled Poems, a plain swallow-tailed livery which in recent years has become just as much de rigueur as the braiding of not long ago, from lunar reveries to symbolic Latin, containing about 50 12-line poems, all devoted to a single theme, childhood. In fervently composing them, the author sought, on the one hand, to generalize reminiscences by selecting elements typical of any successful childhood, hence their seeming obviousness, and, on the other hand, he has allowed only his genuine quiddity to penetrate into his poems, hence their seeming fastidiousness. At the same time, he had to take great pains not to loose either his control of the game or the viewpoint of the plaything. The strategy of inspiration and the tactics of the mind, the flesh of poetry and the specter of translucent prose, these are the epithets that seem to us to characterize with sufficient accuracy the art of this young poet. And having locked his door, he took out his book and threw himself on the couch. He had to reread it right away, before the excitement had time to cool, in order to check the superior quality of the poems and forefancy all the details of the high approbation given them by the intelligent, delightful, as yet unnamed reviewer. And now, as he sampled and tested them, he was doing the exact opposite of what he had done a short time ago when he had skimmed over the book in one instantaneous thought. Now he read in three dimensions, as it were, carefully exploring each poem, lifted out like a cube from among the rest, and bathed from all sides in that wonderful, fluffy country air after which one is always so tired in the evening. In other words, as he read, he again made use of all the materials already once gathered by his memory for the extraction of the present poems, and reconstructed everything, absolutely everything, as a returning traveler sees in an orphan's eyes not only the smile of its mother, whom he had known in his youth, but also an avenue ending in a burst of yellow light, in that auburn leaf on the bench, and everything, everything. The collection opened with the poem The Lost Ball, and one felt it was beginning to rain, one of those evenings heavy with clouds that go so well with our northern furs, had condensed around the house. The avenue had returned from the park for the night, and its entrance was shrouded in dusk. Now the unfolding white shutters separate the room from the exterior darkness, whither the brighter portions of various household objects have already crossed to take up tentative positions on different levels of the helplessly black garden. Bedtime is now at hand. Games grow half-hearted and somewhat callous. She is old, and she groans painfully as she kneels in three laborious stages. My ball has rolled under nurse's commode. On the floor, a candle tugs at the ends of the shadows this way and that, but the ball is gone. Then comes the crooked poker. It potters and clatters in vain, knocks out a button, and then half a swipe back. Suddenly out darts the ball into the quivering darkness, crosses the whole room, and promptly goes under the impregnable sofa. Why doesn't the epithet quivering quite satisfy me? Or does the puppeteer's colossal hand appear here for an instant among the creatures whose size the eye had come to accept, so that the spectator's first reaction at the end of the show is, how big I have grown? After all, the room really was quivering, and that flickering, carousel-like movement of shadows across the wall when the light is being carried away, or the shadowy camel on the ceiling with its monstrous humps heaving when nurse wrestles with the bulky and unstable reed screen, whose expansion is inversely proportional to its degree of equilibrium. These are all my very earliest memories, the ones closest to the original source. My probing thought often turns toward that original source, toward that reverse nothingness. Thus, the nebulous state of the infant always seems to me to be a slow convalescence after a dreadful illness, and the receding from primal non-existence becomes an approach to it when I strain my memory to the very limit so as to taste of that darkness and use its lessons to prepare myself for the darkness to come. But as I turn my life upside down so that birth becomes death, I fail to see at the verge of this dying in reverse anything that would correspond to the boundless terror that even a centenarian is said to experience when he faces the positive end. Nothing, except perhaps the aforementioned shadows, which, rising from somewhere below when the candle takes off to leave the room, while the shadow of the left brass knob at the foot of my bed sweeps past like a black head, swelling as it moves, assume their accustomed places about my nursery cot. And in their corners grow brazen, bearing only a casual likeness to their natural models. In a whole set of poems, disarming by their sincerity, no, that's nonsense. Why must one disarm the reader? Is he dangerous? In a whole set of excellent, or to put it even more strongly, remarkable poems, the author sings not only of these frightening shadows, but of brighter moments as well. Oh, nonsense, I say. He does not write like that, my nameless unknown eulogist. And it was only for his sake that I poetized the memory of two precious and, I think, ancient toys. The first was an ample painted flower pot containing an artificial plant from a sunny land, on which was perched a stuffed tropical songbird, so astonishingly lifelike that it seemed about to take wing, with black plumage and an amethyst breast. And when the big key had been wheedled from the housekeeper, Ivona Ivanovna, inserted in the side of the pot and given several tight, vivifying turns, the little Malayan nightingale would open its beak. No, it would not even open its beak, for something odd had happened to the clockwork mechanism, to some spring or other, which, however, stored up its action for later. The bird would not sing then, but if one forgot about it, and a week later happened to walk past its lofty wardrobe-top perch, then some mysterious tremor would suddenly make it emit its magical warbling. And how marvelously, how long it would trill, puffing out its ruffled little breast. It would finish. Then, on your way out, you would tread on another floorboard, and in special response it would utter a final whistle and grow silent halfway through the note. The other of the poetized toys, which was in another room, also on a high shelf, behaved in similar fashion, but with a zany suggestion of imitation, as the spirit of parody always goes along with genuine poetry. This was a clown in satin plus fours, who was propping himself on two whitewashed parallel bars, and who would be set in motion by an accidental jolt, to the sound of a miniature music with a comical pronunciation, tinkling somewhere beneath his little platform, as he lifted his legs in white stockings and with pom-poms on the shoes, higher and higher, with barely perceptible jerks, and abruptly everything stopped, and he froze in an angular attitude. And perhaps it is the same with my poems. But the truthfulness of juxtapositions and deductions is sometimes better preserved on the near side of the verbal fence. From the accumulating poetical pieces in the book, we gradually obtain the image of an extremely receptive boy living in extremely favorable surroundings. Our poet was born on July 12, 1900, in the Leshino Manor, which for generations had been the country estate of the Godunov-Cherdintsevs. Even before he reached school age, the boy read through a considerable number of books from his father's library. In his interesting reminiscences, so-and-so recalls how enthusiastically little Fedya and his sister Tanya, who was 2 years his elder, engaged in amateur theatricals, and how they would even write plays themselves for their performances. That, my good man, may be true of other poets, but in my case it is a lie. I've always been indifferent to the theater, although I remember that we did have a puppet theater with cardboard trees and a crenellated castle with celluloid windows the color of raspberry jelly, through which painted flames, like those on Vereshchagin's picture of the Moscow fire, flickered when a candle was lighted inside. And it was this candle which, not without our participation, eventually caused the conflagration of the entire building. Oh, but Tanya and I were fastidious when it came to toys. From indifferent givers on the outside, we would often receive quite wretched things. Anything that came in a flat carton with an illustrated cover boded ill. To one such cover, I tried to devote my stipulated 12 lines, but somehow the poem did not rise. A family seated around a circular table illuminated by a lamp. The boy is dressed in an impossible sailor suit with a red tie. The girl wears laced boots, also red. Both, with expressions of sensuous delectation, are stringing beads of various colors on straw-like rods, making little baskets, birdcages, and boxes. And with similar enthusiasm, their half-witted parents take part in the same pastime. The father with a prize growth on his pleased face, the mother with her imposing bosom. The dog is also looking at the table, and envious grandma can be seen ensconced in the background. Those same children have now grown up, and I often run across them in advertisements. He, with his glossy, sleekly tanned cheeks, is puffing voluptuously on a cigarette, or holding in his brawny hand with a carnivorous grin a sandwich containing something red. Eat more meat. She is smiling at a stocking she herself is wearing, or with depraved delight pouring artificial cream on canned fruit. And in time they will become sprightly, rosy, gormandizing oldsters, and still have ahead of them the infernal black beauty of oaken caskets in a palm-decked display window. Thus, a world of handsome demons develops side by side with us, in a cheerfully sinister relationship to our everyday existence. But in the handsome demon there is always some secret flaw, a shameful wart on the behind of this semblance of perfection. The glamorous glutton of the advertisement, gorging himself on gelatin, can never know the quiet joys of the gourmet. And his fashions, lingering on the billboard while we move onward, are always just a little behind those of real life. Someday I shall come back to a discussion of this nemesis, which finds a soft spot for its blow, exactly where the whole sense and power of the creature it strikes seems to lie. In general, Tanya and I preferred sweaty games to quiet ones. Running, hide-and-seek, battles. How remarkably the word battle, сражение, suggests the sound of springy compression when one rammed into the toy gun its projectile, a 6-inch stick of colored wood, deprived of its rubber suction cup in order to increase the impact with which it struck the gilt tin of a breastplate worn by a cross between a cuirassier and a redskin, making in it a respectable little dent. You reload to the bottom the barrel, with a creaking of springs resiliently pressing it down on the floor, and you see, half-concealed by the door, that your double has stopped in the mirror, rainbow feathers in headband standing on end. The author had occasion to hide. We are now in the Godunov Cherdintsev's mansion on the English quay of the Neva, where it stands even today, among draperies, under tables, behind the upright cushions of silk divans, in a wardrobe where moth crystals crunched under one's feet, and whence one could observe unseen a slowly passing manservant, who would seem strangely different, alive, ethereal, smelling of apples and tea, and also under a helical staircase or behind a lonely buffet forgotten in a bare room, on whose dusty shelves vegetated such objects as a necklace made of wolf's teeth, a small bare-bellied idol of almatolite, another of porcelain, its black tongue stuck out in national greeting, a chess set with camels instead of bishops, an articulated wooden dragon, a swayo snuff-box of clouded glass, ditto of agate, a shaman's tambourine and the rabbit's foot going with it, a book of wapiti leather with an inner sole made from the bark of the blue honeysuckle, an ensiform Tibetan coin, a cup of Kara jade, a silver brooch with turquoises, a lama's lampad, and a lot of similar junk, which, like dust, like the postcard from a German spa with its mother-of-pearl grus, my father, who could not stomach ethnography, somehow happened to bring back from his fabulous travels. The real treasures, his butterfly collection, his museum, were preserved in 3 locked halls. But the present book of poems contains nothing about that. A special intuition forewarned the young author that someday he would want to speak in quite another way, not in miniature verse with charms and chimes, but in very, very different manly words about his famous father. Again, something has gone wrong, and one hears the flippantly flat little voice of the reviewer, perhaps even of the female sex. With warm affection, the poet recalls the rooms of the family house where it, his childhood, was spent. He has been able to imbue with much lyricism the poetic descriptions of objects among which it was spent. When you listen closely, we all attentively and piously, the strains of the past. Thus, for instance, he depicts lampshades, lithographs on the walls, his schoolroom desk, the weekly visit of the floor polishers, who leave behind an odor compounded of frost, sweat, and mastic, and the checking of the clocks. On Thursdays there comes from the clock shop a courteous old man who proceeds to wind with a leisurely hand all the clocks in the house. He steals at his own watch a glance and sets the clock on the wall. He stands on a chair, and he waits for the clock to discharge its noon completely. Then, having done well his agreeable task, he soundlessly puts back the chair, and with a slight whir the clock ticks, giving an occasional tongue clack with its pendulum and making a strange pause as if to gather its strength before striking. Its ticking, like an unrolled tape divided by stripes into inches, served as an endless measure of my insomnias. It was just as hard for me to fall asleep as to sneeze without having tickled with something the inside of a nostril, or to commit suicide by resorting to means at the body's disposal, swallowing my tongue or something like that. At the beginning of the agonizing night, I could still play for time by subsisting on conversations with Tanya, whose bed stood in the next room. Despite rules, we would open the door slightly. And then, when we heard our governess going to her own room, which was adjacent to Tanya's, one of us would gently shut it. A lightning barefoot sprint and then a dive into bed. While the door was ajar, we would exchange conundrums from room to room, every now and then lapsing into silence. I can still hear the tone of this twin silence in the dark. She to guess mine, I to think of another. Mine were always on the fantastic and silly side, while Tanya adhered to classical models. Mon premier est un métal précieux. Mon second est un habitant des cieux. Et mon tout est un fruit délicieux. Sometimes she would fall asleep, while I waited patiently, thinking that she was struggling with my riddle, and neither my pleading nor my imprecations would succeed in reviving her. After this, I would voyage for more than an hour through the dark of my bed, arching the bedclothes over myself so as to form a cavern, at whose distant exit I glimpsed a bit of a bleak bluish light that had nothing in common with my bedroom, with the Neva night, with the rich, darkly translucent flounces of the window curtains. The cave I was exploring held in its folds and fissures such a dreamy reality, brimmed with such oppressive mystery, that a throbbing as of a muted drum would begin in my chest and in my ears. In there, in its depths, where my father had discovered a new species of bat, I could make out the high cheekbones of an idol hewn from the rock. And when I finally dozed off, a dozen strong hands would overturn me, and with an awful silk-ripping sound, someone would unstitch me from top to bottom, after which an agile hand would slip inside me and powerfully squeeze my heart. Or else I would be turned into a horse, screaming in a Mongolian voice. Shamans yanked at its hocks with lassos so that its legs would break with a crunch and collapse at right angles to the body, my body, which lay with its chest pressed against the yellow ground. And as a sign of extreme agony, the horse's tail would rise fountain-like. It dropped back, and I awoke. Time to get up. The stove heater pats the glistening facings of the stove to determine if the fire has grown to the top. It has, and to its hot hum the morning responds with the silence of snow, pink-shaded azure, and immaculate whiteness. It is strange how a memory will grow into a wax figure, how the cherub grows suspiciously prettier as its frame darkens with age. Strange, strange are the mishaps of memory. I emigrated 7 years ago. This foreign land has by now lost its aura of a broadness, just as my own ceased to be a geographic habit. The year 7. The wandering ghost of an empire immediately adopted this system of reckoning, akin to the one formerly introduced by the ardent French citizen in honor of newborn liberty. But the years roll on, and honor is no consolation. Recollections either melt away or else acquire a deathly gloss, so that instead of marvelous apparitions, we are left with a fan of picture postcards. Nothing can help here. No poetry, no stereoscope. That gadget which in ominous bug-eyed silence used to endow a cupola with such convexity, and surround mug-carrying Carlsbad promenaders with such a diabolical semblance of space that I was tormented by nightmares after this optical diversion far more than after tales of Mongolian tortures. The particular stereo camera that I remember adorned the waiting room of our dentist, an American named Lawson, whose French mistress, Madame Ducon, a gray-haired harpy, seated at her desk among vials of blood-red Lawson mouthwash, pursed her lips and nervously scratched her scalp as she tried to find an appointment for Tanya and me, and finally, with an effort and a screech, managed to push her spitting pen between La Princesse Toumanoff, with a blot at the end, and Monsieur Dansas, with a blot at the beginning. Here is the description of a drive to this dentist, who had warned the day before that this one will have to come out. What will it be like to be sitting half an hour from now in this brougham? With what eyes shall I look at these snowflakes and black branches of trees? How shall I follow again with my gaze that conical curbstone in its cotton-wool cap? How recall on my way back my way there? While with revulsion and tenderness, constantly feeling the handkerchief wherein carefully folded is something like an ivory watch-charm. That cotton-wool cap is not only ambiguous, but does not even begin to express what I meant, namely, the snow piled cap-like on granite cones joined by a chain somewhere in the vicinity of the statue of Peter the Great. Somewhere. Alas, it is already difficult for me to gather all the parts of the past. Already I'm beginning to forget relationships and connections between objects that still thrive in my memory, objects I thereby condemn to extinction. If so, what insulting mockery to affirm smugly that thus a former impression keeps living within harmony's ice. What then compels me to compose poems about my childhood, if in spite of everything my words go wide of the mark? Or else slay both the pod and the heart with the exploding bullet of an accurate epithet. But let us not despair. The man says I am a real poet, which means that the hunt was not in vain. Here is another 12-line poem about boyhood torments. It deals with the ordeals of winter in town, when, for example, ribbed stockings chafe behind the knees, or when the shop girl pulls an impossibly flat kid glove onto your hand, laid on the counter as if on an executioner's block. There is more. The hook's double pinch, the first time it slipped off, while you stand with outspread arms to have your fur collar fastened. But in compensation for this, what an amusing change in acoustics! How rounded all sounds become when the collar is raised! And, since we have touched upon ears, how unforgettable the silky, taut, buzzing music while the strings of your cap's ear flaps are being tied. Raise your chin. Merrily, to coin a phrase, youngsters romp on a frosty day. At the entrance of the public park, we have the balloon vendor. Above his head, three times his size, an enormous rustling cluster. Look, children, how they billow and rub against each other, all full of God's sunshine in red, blue, and green shades. A beautiful sight. Please, Uncle, I want the biggest. The white one, with the rooster painted on it, and the red embryo floating inside, which, when its mother is destroyed, will escape up to the ceiling, and a day later will come down all wrinkled and quite tame. Now the happy children have bought their ruble balloon, and the kindly hawker has pulled it out of the jostling bunch. Just a minute, my lad, don't grab. Let me cut the string. After which he puts on his mittens again, checks the string around his waist from which his scissors dangle, and, pushing off with his heel, slowly begins to rise in an upright position higher and higher into the blue sky. Look, his cluster is no larger now than a bunch of grapes, while beneath him lies hazy, gilded, berimed St. Petersburg. A little restored here and there, alas, according to the best pictures of our national painters. But joking aside, it really was all very beautiful, very quiet. The trees in the park mimed their own ghosts, and the whole effect revealed immense talent. Tanya and I would make fun of the sleds of our coevals, especially if they were covered with fringed carpet-like stuff and had a high seat, equipped even with a back, and reins that the rider held as he braked with his felt boots. This kind never made it all the way to the final snowdrift, but instead went off course almost immediately and began to spin helplessly while continuing to descend, carrying a pallid, intent child who was obliged, when the sled's momentum was spent, to work with his feet in order to reach the end of the icy run. Tanya and I had weighty belly sleds from Sangalis. Such a sled consisted simply of a rectangular velvet cushion on iron runners curved at each end. You did not have to pull it on the way to the slide. It glided with so little effort and so impatiently along the snow, sanded in vain, that it bumped against your heels. Here we are at the hill. One climbed up a sparkle-splashed platform. Water carried up in buckets to pour on the slide had splashed over the wooden steps so that they were coated with sparkling ice, but the well-meaning alliteration had not been able to get all this in. One climbed a sparkle-splashed platform. One dashingly fell belly-first on the sled, and it rattled down the blueness. And then, when the scene underwent a grim change, and there somberly burned in the nursery scarlet fever on Christmas or on Easter diphtheria, one rocketed down the bright, brittle, exaggerated ice hill in a kind of half-tropical, half-Tavrichesky park, where, by the power of delirium, General Nikolai Mikhailovich Przewalski was transferred, together with his stone camel, from the Alexandrovsky park near us, and where he immediately turned into a statue of my father, who was at that moment somewhere between Kokand and Ashgabad, for example, or else on a slope of the Tsinin range. What illnesses Tanya and I went through, now together, now by turns, and how I would suffer when I heard between the slam of a distant door and the restrained, quiet sound of another one, her footfall and laughter bursting through, sounding celestially indifferent to me, unaware of me, infinitely distant from my fat compress with its tawny oilcloth filling, my aching legs, my bodily heaviness and constriction. But if it was she who was sick, how earthly and real, how like a crisp soccer ball I felt when I saw her lying in bed with an air of remoteness about her, as if she had turned toward the other world, with only the limp lining of her being toward me. Let us describe the last stand before the capitulation, when, not yet having stepped out of the normal course of the day, concealing from your own self the fever, the ache in your joints, and wrapping yourself up Mexican fashion, you disguise the claims of fever's chill as the demands of the game. And when a half hour later you have surrendered and ended up in bed, your body no longer believes that just a short time ago it was playing, crawling on all fours along the floor of the hall, along the parquet, along the carpe. Let us describe Mother's questioning smile of alarm when she has just put the thermometer in my armpit, a task she would not entrust either to the valet or to the governess. "Well, you've got yourself into a nice fix, haven't you?" says she, still trying to joke about it. Then a minute later, "I knew it yesterday. I knew you had a fever. You can't fool me." And after another minute, "How much do you think you have?" And finally, "I think we can take it out now." She brings the incandescent glass tube close to the light, and drawing together her lovely sealskin eyebrows, which Tanya has inherited, she looks for a long time. And then, without saying anything, she unhurriedly shakes the thermometer and slips it back into its case, looking at me as if not quite recognizing me. While my father rides his horse at a walk across a vernal plain, all blue with irises. Let us describe also the delirious state in which one feels huge numbers grow, inflating one's brain, accompanied by someone's incessant patter, quite unrelated to you, as if in the dark garden adjoining the madhouse of the Book of Sums, several of its characters, half out, or more precisely, 57/111 out of their terrible world of increasing interests, appeared in their stock parts of Apple Woman, Four Ditch Diggers, and a certain person who has bequeathed his children a caravan of fractions, and chattered to the accompaniment of the nocturnal sough of trees about something extremely domestic and silly, but therefore all the more awful, all the more doomed to turn into those very numbers, into that mathematical universe expanding endlessly, an expansion which for me sheds an odd light on the macrocosmic theories of today's physicists. Let us describe, finally, the recovery, when there is no longer any point in shaking the mercury down, and the thermometer is carelessly left lying on the bed table, where an assembly of books that has come to congratulate you, and a few playthings, idle onlookers, are crowding out the half-empty bottles of turbid potions. A writing case with my notepaper is what I most vividly see. The leaves are adorned with a horseshoe and my monogram. I had become quite an expert in twisted initials, intaglio seals, dry flattened flowers, which a little girl sent me from Nice, and sealing wax, red and bronze gleaming. None of the poems in the book alludes to a certain extraordinary thing that happened to me as I was recovering from a particularly severe case of pneumonia. When everyone had moved into the drawing room, to use a Victorian cliché, one of the guests who, to go on with it, had been silent all evening. The fever had ebbed away during the night, and I'd finally scrambled ashore. I was, let me tell you, weak, capricious, and transparent as a cut-glass egg. Mother had gone to buy me, I did not know what exactly, one of those freakish things that from time to time I coveted with the greed of a pregnant woman, afterwards forgetting them completely. But my mother made lists of these desiderata. As I lay flat in bed among bluish layers of indoor twilight, I felt myself evolving an incredible lucidity, as when a distant stripe of radiantly pale sky stretches between long vesperal clouds, and you can make out the cape and shallows of God knows what far-off islands. And it seems that if you release your volatile glance just a little further, you will discern a shining boat drawn up on the damp sand and receding footsteps filled with bright water. In that minute, I think, I attained the highest limit of human health. My mind had been dipped and rinsed only recently in a dangerous, supernaturally clean blackness, and now, lying still and not even shutting my eyes, I mentally saw my mother, in chinchilla coat and black dotted veil, getting into the sleigh, which always seemed in old Russia so small compared to the tremendous stuffed bottom of the coachman, and holding her dove-gray fluffy muff to her face as she sped behind a pair of black horses covered with a blue net. Street after street unfolded without any effort on my part. Lumps of coffee-colored snow pounded against the sleigh's front. Now it has stopped. Vasily the footman steps down from his footboard, in the same motion unfastening the bearskin lap-robe, and my mother walks briskly toward a shop whose name and display I do not have time to identify, since just at that instant my uncle, her brother, passes by and hails her, but she's already disappeared, and for several steps I involuntarily accompany him, trying to make out the face of the gentleman with whom he is chatting as they both walk away, but catching myself I turn back and hastily flow, as it were, into the store, where my mother is already paying 10 rubles for a perfectly ordinary green Faber pencil, which is then lovingly wrapped in brown paper by two clerks and handed to Vasily, who is already carrying it behind my mother to the sleigh, which now speeds along anonymous streets back to our house, now advancing to meet it. But here the crystalline course of my clairvoyance was interrupted by Ivana Ivanovna's arrival with broth and toast. I needed her help to sit up in bed. She gave the pillow a swat and placed the bed tray, with its midget feet in a perpetually sticky area near its southwestern corner, across the animated blanket before me. Suddenly the door opened, and Mother came in, smiling and holding a long brown paper package like a halberd. From it emerged a Faber pencil, a yard long and of corresponding thickness, a display giant that had hung horizontally in the window as an advertisement and had once happened to arouse my whimsical greed. I must still have been in that blissful state when any oddity descends among us like a demigod to mingle unrecognized with the Sunday crowd, since at that moment I felt no amazement at what had happened to me, but only remarked to myself in passing how I had been mistaken in regard to the object's size. But later, when I had grown stronger and plugged up certain chinks with bread, I would ponder with superstitious pangs about my clairvoyant spell, the only one I ever experienced, of which I was so ashamed that I concealed it even from Tanya. and I nearly burst into tears from embarrassment when we happened to meet on my very first trip outdoors a distant relative of Mother's, one Gadyukov, who said to her, "Your brother and I saw you the other day near Trimans." Meanwhile, the air in the poems has grown warmer, and we're preparing to return to the country where we might move as early as April in the years before I began school. I began it only at the age of 12. The snow, gone from the slopes, lurks in ravines, and the Petersburg spring is full of excitement and of anemones and of the first butterflies. But I don't need last year's Vanessas, those bleached hibernators, or those utterly battered brimstones through transparent woods flying. I shall not fail, though, to detect the four lovely gauze wings of the softest geometrid moth in the world spread flat on the mottled pale birch trunk. This poem is the author's own favorite, but he did not include it in the collection because, once again, the theme is connected with that of his father, and economy of art advised him not to touch that theme before the right time came. Instead, he reproduced such spring impressions as the first sensation immediately upon walking out of the station, the softness of the ground, its kindred proximity to your foot, and around your head the totally unrestrained flow of air. Vying with each other, furiously lavishing invitations, standing up on their boxes, flourishing their free hand, and mingling their uproar with exaggerated whoas, the droshky drivers called to the early arrivals. A little way off, an open motor car, crimson both inside and out, awaited us. The idea of speed had already given a slant to the steering wheel. Sea cliff trees will understand what I mean. While its general appearance still retained, out of a false sense of propriety, I suppose, a servile link with the shape of a Victoria. But if this was indeed an attempt at mimicry, then it was totally destroyed by the roar of the motor with the muffler bypass opened, a roar so ferocious that long before we came in sight, a peasant on a hay wagon coming the other way would jump off and try to hood his horse with a sack, after which he and his cart would often end up in the ditch or even in the field, where a minute later, having already forgotten us and our dust, the rural stillness would collect again, cool and tender, with only the tiniest aperture left for the song of a skylark. Perhaps one day, on foreign-made soles with heels long since worn down, feeling myself a ghost, despite the idiotic substantiality of the insulators, I shall again come out of that station, and without visible companions walk along the footpath that accompanies the highway the 10 or so versts to Leshino. One after another the telegraph poles will hum at my approach. A crow will settle on a boulder, settle and straighten a wing that is folded wrong. The day will probably be on the grayish side. Changes in the appearance of the surrounding landscape that I cannot imagine, as well as some of the oldest landmarks that somehow I have forgotten, will greet me alternately, even mingling from time to time. I think that as I walk, I shall utter something like a moan in tune with the poles. When I reach the sites where I grew up and see this and that, or else because of fires, rebuilding, lumbering operations, or the negligence of nature, see neither this nor that, but still make out something infinitely and unwaveringly faithful to me, if only because my eyes are in the long run made of the same stuff as the grayness, the clarity, the dampness of those sights. Then, after all the excitement, I shall experience a certain satiation of suffering, perhaps on the mountain pass to a kind of happiness which it is too early for me to know. I know only that when I reach it, it will be with pen in hand. But there is one thing I shall definitely not find there awaiting me, the thing which indeed made the whole business of exile worth cultivating, my childhood and the fruits of my childhood. Its fruits? Here they are today, already ripe, while my childhood itself has disappeared into a distance even more remote than that of our Russian north. The author has found effective words to describe sensations experienced upon making the transition to the countryside. How much fun it is, says he, when, No longer one needs to put on a cap or change one's light shoes in order to run out again in the spring on the brick-colored sand of the garden. At the age of 10, a new diversion was added. We were still in the city when the marvel rolled in. For quite a time I led it around by its ram horns from room to room. With what bashful grace it moved along the parquet floor until it impaled itself on a thumbtack. Compared to my old rattling and pitiful little tricycle, whose wheels were so thin that it would get stuck even in the sand of the garden terrace, the newcomer possessed a heavenly lightness of movement. This is well expressed by the poet in the following lines. Oh, that first bicycle, its splendor, its height, Dux or Poveda inscribed on its frame, the quietness of its tight tire, the wavers and weavers in the green avenue, where sun macules glide up one's wrists and where molehills loom black and threaten one's downfall. But next day one skims over them, and support as in dreamland is lacking, and trusting in this dream simplicity, the bicycle does not collapse. And the day after that, there inevitably come thoughts of freewheeling, a word which to this day I cannot hear without seeing a strip of smooth, sloping, sticky ground glide past, accompanied by a barely audible murmur of rubber and an ever-so-gentle lisp of steel. Bicycling and riding, boating and bathing, tennis and croquet, picnicking under the pines, the lure of the watermill in the hayloft. This is a general list of the themes that move our author. What about his poems from the point of view of form? These, of course, are miniatures, but they are executed with a phenomenally delicate mastery that brings out clearly every hair, not because everything is delineated with an excessively selective touch, but because the presence of the smallest features is involuntarily conveyed to the reader by the integrity and reliability of a talent that assures the author's observance of all the articles of the artistic covenant. One can argue whether it is worthwhile to revive album-type poetry, but one certainly cannot deny that within the limits he has set himself, Godunov Cherdintsev has solved his prosodic problem correctly. Each of his poems iridesces with harlequin colors. Whoever is fond of the picturesque genre will appreciate this little volume. To the blind man at the church door it would have nothing to say. What vision the author has! Awaking early in the morning, he knew what kind of a day it would be by looking at a chink in the shutter, which showed a blue that was bluer than blue and was hardly inferior in blueness to my present remembrance of it. And in the evening he gazes with the same screwed-up eyes at the field, one side of which is already in shadow, while the other, farther one, is illumined from its central big boulder to the edge of the forest beyond it, and is bright as by day. It would seem to us that perhaps it was really not literature, but painting for which he was destined from childhood, and while we know nothing of the author's present condition, we can nevertheless clearly picture a straw-hatted boy sitting very uncomfortably on a garden bench with his watercolor paraphernalia and painting the world bequeathed him by his forebears. Cells of white porcelain contain blue, green, red honey. First, out of pencil lines, on rough paper a garden is formed. The birches, the balcony of the outbuilding, all is spotted with sunlight. I soak and twirl tight the tip of my paintbrush in rich orange-yellow, and meantime within the full goblet, in the radiance of its cut glass, what colors have blazed, what rapture has bloomed. This, then, is Godunov Cherdintsev's little volume. In conclusion, let us add, what else, imagination, do prompt me. Can it be true that all the enchantingly throbbing things of which I have dreamt and still dream through my poems have not been lost in them and have been noticed by the reader whose review I shall see before the day is over? Can it really be that he has understood everything in them, understood that besides the good old picturesqueness, they also contain special poetic meaning? when one's mind, after going round itself in the subliminal labyrinth, returns with newfound music that alone makes poems what they should be? As he read them, did he read them not only as words, but as chinks between words, as one should do when reading poetry? Or did he simply skim over them, like them and praise them, calling attention to the significance of their sequence, a feature fashionable in our time, when time is in fashion? If a collection opens with a poem about a lost ball, it must close with the found ball. Only pictures and icons remained in their places that year when childhood was ended and something happened to the old house. In a hurry, all the rooms with each other were exchanging their furniture, cupboards and screens, and a host of unwieldy big things. And it was then that from under a sofa, on the suddenly unmasked parquet, alive and incredibly dear, it was revealed in a corner. The book's exterior appearance is pleasing. Having squeezed the final drop of sweetness from it, Fyodor stretched and got up from his couch. He felt very hungry. The hands of his watch had lately begun to misbehave, now and then starting to move counterclockwise, so that he could not depend on them. To judge by the light, however, the day, about to leave on a journey, had sat down with its family for a pensive pause. When Fyodor went outside, he felt immersed in a damp chill. It's a good thing I put that on. While he'd been musing over his poems, rain had lacquered the street from end to end. The van had gone, and in the spot where its tractor had recently stood, there remained next to the sidewalk a rainbow of oil, with the purple predominant, and a plume-like twist. Asphalt's parakeet. And what had been the name of the moving company? Max Lux. Max Luck. Did I take the keys? Fyodor suddenly thought, stopping and thrusting his hand into his raincoat pocket. There he located a clinking handful, weighty and reassuring. When 3 years ago, still during his existence here as a student, his mother had moved to Paris to live with Tanya, she had written that she just could not get used to being liberated from the perpetual fetters that chain a Berliner to the door lock.